Take a deep breath and say, I'm Jim Brandt, and the series that I'm doing this week is called, what's it called? It's called Conversations with Fellow Travelers. And tonight, this is session two, and we're doing Julian of Norwich. And Julian was a 15th century mystic. And no, you don't need to know anything about Julian to start tonight, but I hope you'll learn a little bit about her tonight. And more especially, I hope you'll begin to imagine what a conversation would be like between your life and Julian's life, and what the two might say to each other, and what they might learn from each other. In the process. What I want to do this evening is spend a little time in the beginning talking to you about how I conceive my work and explain that to give you some sense of how I go at things, or at least how I think I'm going at things. And then I'll talk about Julian for a while. And then probably the last 20 minutes or so, I want to give you a question to work on and have you get into some small groups and do some discussion. So that's kind of where we're headed. Conversation. I imagine my work as conversation. And there are several different parties to the conversation. One of the parties is the figure that I try to bring to us. Last time we talked about St. Augustine, tonight Julian. In the next three sessions, we're going to talk about, try to hear Frederick Buechner, and then James Carroll, and then Maya Angelou, who are contemporary figures, and listen to a bit of their story. And in those three sessions, I've got a video that's real new, and it's called Sacred Stories with Frederick Buechner, Maya Angelou, and James Carroll. And I just mentioned that tonight because there were some people who I know are leaving and who had asked me about the video. So if anyone is interested in the video, you can grab me after class, and I'd be glad to give you whatever information's on here so that you can. But that's what we'll be doing in the next three sessions. So one of the conversation partners is one of these figures. One of the conversation partners is you, each of you as an individual. Another conversation partner are the other people who are here. So I hope that we'll spend a little time talking to each other, but also that this will generate ongoing conversation through the week as we get to know each other a little bit and start to talk together. I teach in the area of historical theology. And I do so at a United Methodist Seminary in Kansas City, Missouri. And the Methodists, like I hope most of us, are real concerned about inclusiveness. And when we are planning to teach a class, there are certain things we're really required to deal with. And I'm sure you're familiar with most of the isms that we are committed, not just required, but committed to dealing with. Of course, there's racism and sexism and classism. We could talk about sexism, we could talk about heterosexism in relationship to that too. But those are the three that we usually name at St. Paul. There's another one that never makes the list. It really kind of fries me, at least as a historian, and that is what I call presentism. You all know what presentism is, right? You probably don't, because I just made it up today. I was just thinking about it. And, one of the problems that I struggle with as a historian is what I call presentism, or a chauvinism of the present. A chauvinism of the present. I mean, really, down deep, I think all of us believe, in one way or another, all of us believe in progress. We believe that the world is getting better and human beings are getting smarter. Now, we don't like to admit it because we do look around at the world and we see a lot of terrible things happening. And it's hard to believe in progress in a century that has witnessed the use of nuclear weapons and the horrors of the Nazis. But we do. I think it's pretty deep in most of us. And because we believe in progress and believe that really this is the best time to be alive, we really don't think that figures from the past have much to say to us. And I find that with my students most of the time. We're writing a paper on a historical figure, and they want to analyze the figure, and then finally they want to show how the figure really doesn't measure up. You know, that today we're beyond that, and we know things that that person or those people didn't know. And you can. I hope you can understand why, as a historian, it's a matters. I think we're all sort of affected by what Henry Ford said. Henry Ford, the industrialist, you know, said, "History is bunk. History is bunk." And why is that? I think that's for Henry Ford because, you know, what was Henry Ford's great pioneering work? It was mechanized ways of making things. And once you figure it out, you just do it over and over again. Right? You figure out how to do this assembly line and move things down and start with some metal and end up with a car. And once you figure it out, you've got it. And you don't want any surprises in that process, right? You want it to go along smoothly. Well, history is about, I think, it's about surprises. It's about new things happening. And it's about us discovering that some things we think are new are in fact going on long before we do. So I fight a lot against what I call the chauvinism of the present. And I'll try not to be too nasty about it tonight, but it is something that I worry about. And especially doing people like last time we did Augustine, and tonight we're doing Julian. And as you'll hear in a little bit, Julian is a mystic, and she's really, at your first introduction, you may well think, this woman is sick. there's some strange stuff in Julian, and I've had a lot of students say, you know, if she just had a good therapist, she would have been all right. And, you see, I think someone who says, if she had a good therapist, she would have been all right, I think that person is suffering from a chauvinism of the present. Because it's this sense that if she looked at the world the way we do, you know, where we take psychology and we take what therapists can do for us very seriously, we think it can really cure a lot of our problems, we're not opening ourselves to the way she sees the world. And the problems she struggles with and the answers she finds. Instead, we're writing her off and saying, if she were only a person of the late 20th century, she wouldn't have these kind of problems. And it's a way of, it can be, it's not always, but it can be a way of dismissing her. And that worries me because I think from people like Julian, we have so much to gain if we can really hear her, really hear what she's about. Okay, so that's my little speech about the ism that that I struggle against. And another way to say that, though, is to say that what I hope for is for us to see that difference. Difference doesn't have to be a dirty word. And again, I think for a lot of us, difference is. If we see something that's different, many of us are really prone to figure out what's wrong with it. If we see a person who operates in a way, a different way from the way we operate. My spouse is here, so I can maybe talk about us a little bit. My spouse is a Presbyterian minister, and I'm Lutheran, a Lutheran minister. And I know that at least I struggle often with thinking that, well, she's different. And it's real easy for me to see the weaknesses in her own tradition.
I didn't hear the whole sentence. In her own tradition.
No. You know, and I think part of that is that sense, that underlying sense that I'm nervous about difference. Because part of me wants everyone to be like me. Well, wouldn't that be a lovely world? But crucial, I think, to the learning process is being open to and not threatened by difference. To see that different people are really different from us, and to really hear how they're different and not try to... I mean, the other way we respond to difference often is we sort of try to make them like us. We find something in Julie and say, oh, she didn't really mean that. She didn't really want to experience the passion of Christ, which is here. That's one of the things she wanted, to sort of witness Christ's passion. That's one of the things that makes people think she's kind of sick. But it's important, I think, to take her at her word when she says that she wanted to experience that. And not to try to smooth over those differences, but to live with them and to learn from them. One of the things that I say often to my students is when they're trying to figure out where they are theologically, I'll often say, okay, if you think of yourself primarily as a liberal, then you go find some conservative author, and you really work through the conservative author. And if you think of yourself as a conservative, then you find some liberal author, and you really try to work through it and understand. Because I think often it's in that kind of encounter with someone different that we really learn a lot about ourselves and about the other. So that's sort of tagging on to my piece about presentism, that I hope you'll kind of be open to difference and not try to make different people, not try to make, say, a 15th century mystic into a 20th century person, because she's not. But at the same time, one of the things that fascinates me about Julian is that I find in her, she would never have identified herself as a feminist, but I find in her a lot of sort of proto-feminist themes that I, on first reading, was really surprised. And I thought, you know, this is something that we progressive 20th century people have figured out, and they didn't really know about it. About sexism and about that kind of oppression. And of course, she doesn't use those words, but she's on to some things, I think.
we have just been working with. Julian's dates, just to, I'm terrible with dates, so I always have to write them down. Just kind of bad being a historian. That's why I never ask, there's only like two dates that I really insist that my students know, because
they're the only two he can remember.
That's right. That's right. Julian's dates are 1342. We know that for sure because she tells us that in her one work that's available to us. And she died maybe about 1417. We're not really sure. And she lived in the English town of Norwich, N-O-R-W-I-C-H. And Julian was, as I said, a mystic, and we classify her as a mystic because she had a series of revelations, visions, that she was convinced came from God. And after she had these revelations while she was sick and with fever, and so that's, you know, that's hearing that, there's a lot of 20th century people that would, you know, write it off as the result of the sickness and not take it seriously. But I think it needs to be taken seriously. Her book that's available to us is called Showings, and this is it here, and it had to be translated from Middle English, because that period is not quite modern English, it's really a Middle English, and so the work had to be translated from Middle English. And the work is, she worked on it for about 20 years, and the work is a series of reflections on these visions that she had had. When did she had those on May 13th, 1373, you know, so she was 31 years old. That can be a crisis time for a lot of us, and that's when she had these visions, and then spent at least the next 20 years thinking about these visions, and wrote this book in which she's trying to unpack what these visions were about. The other thing that Julian was an anchoress. Or sometimes say an anchorite. And an anchoress is a contemplative person, a person who's leading a contemplative life, but an anchoress or an anchorite doesn't live in community. We think of monks and nuns who lived in community together and worked out a communal life, but then their focus was on contemplation. Anchorites were people who lived the contemplative life, but they did so alone. And we're pretty sure that Julian lived in one cell that was attached to the cathedral in Norwich. And our best guess is that there were two windows in this cell. One that opened out to the street outside, and one that opened into the cathedral so that she could receive the sacraments of the church and be involved in worship there. I don't know about you, but that doesn't sound very appealing to me. It's a way to live, cooped up in one room and spending your life basically in prayer and meditation. But one of the things that it might be important for us to think about in terms of Julian being a woman in this period was devoting herself to this kind of life afforded her a couple things. On the one hand, somehow she had received an education, and that's clear from reading her work, that she was well educated, particularly in theology. But that was not something that many women of that period could get. In fact, about the only way you could get yourself educated was to devote yourself to the church and to the contemplative life. So the purpose, you know, in that period of a woman getting educated was so that she could further her own spirituality and that of those around her. So provided her a kind of social position where she could be educated, and also we have some record that people must have gone to her as sort of a counselor. One of Julian's contemporaries was a woman by the name of Marguerite of Kemp. Now Julian, we might think Julian's crazy, but compared to Marguerite, I think Julian is really sane. Marguerite traveled around a lot, and she would go into churches, and she would have charismatic seizures in the churches, and she would speak in tongues, and she would preach at people, and she would pray, and she was really, Marguerite was really a pretty stern moralist, and so she really wanted people to give up their abuse of alcohol, and she wanted people to give up sexual relations, and really just was real strict, and so she would travel around, and she got herself in all kinds of trouble with the ecclesiastical authorities because she didn't have, you know, permission to do this, but she traveled around, and she writes her autobiography. Well, and she had visions all the time, and in this period, one of the questions is, if you have a vision, is this vision of God or is it of the devil? And Marguerite really struggled with that for herself. You know, are these visions authentic or are they from the devil? And so Marguerite went to Julian, and she writes this in her autobiography, and she says, Julian, how do I know? How do I know if these are authentic visions or not? And Julian's answer was, which Marguerite tells us, Julian's answer was, if your visions promote love, they are of God. And if they do not, they're of the devil. And that helped Marguerite some, gave her some peace in terms of her visions. So what I'm saying is that by, you know, shutting herself up in a cell, which we think of as probably a pretty crazy thing to do, it afforded Julian a kind of authority in her own communities where she could be a religious counselor to folks. And so there's a way in which she was able to do some things that many women in her day were not able to. Okay, let me... Any comments or questions so far?
Are you going to read us what she saw?
What she saw? Mm-hmm. She saw a series of, I wasn't planning on it, she saw a series of, let's see. Yeah. Well, let's see. What was the first revelation? I can tell you some. The first is of his precious, this is Christ. They're all about Jesus. Real. She's real focused on Jesus and on Jesus' passion. The first is about his precious crowning of thorns. And then she go for pages. And sometimes you just lose the connection. You say, I've lost thorns altogether. The second was about the discoloration of Jesus' face. And some are real abstract. Like the third is revelation that God does everything that happens. The fourth is about Jesus, the scourging of Jesus' body. So it's all kinds of things, some of them real concrete, like Jesus' face being discolored, and some kind of abstract theological ones. But no, I wasn't going to tell you all of those. Let me tell you a little bit about Julian's ideas. And Julian is a first-rate theologian. And she is really good, I think. And she wrestles with the difficult theological questions. And the one that's right at the center for her is, why is there sin? And why is there suffering? I mean, isn't that about the hardest theological question or hardest personal question that any of us ever face? And that's the one that's running throughout her work, and she's really wrestling. And she does so, obviously, as a Christian, and one who takes God's power very seriously. So one of the things she says is that nothing happens by chance. And immediately you can see she has raised one of the hardest theological questions, because she's going to recognize that sin and suffering exist in the world, and she's saying nothing happens by chance, that somehow, in some way, God is behind everything. Well, I mean, now we've got problems, don't we? Because we've got sin and suffering in the world, and we don't want to think of God as one who imposes sin and suffering on people, but Julian has sort of made it appear that God is somehow responsible for all this. How is she going to work herself out of that? She's going to try the best she can. Nothing happens by chance, she says. But God does know sin. Okay, keep talking, Julian. I want to see how this works. Nothing happens by chance, but God does know sin. All God's works, she says, are full of grace and mercy. She says the devil's power, and Julian took the devil very seriously, the devil's power is locked in God's hands. And she says everything that the devil does will turn into blessing for the saved. And her phrase is actually those who will be saved. She always phrases it that way. Well, here's a person clearly who's struggling with the reality of sin and evil, and saying that somehow God lets it happen or God is responsible. And come on, Julian, how are you going to pull all this together? In a way, she ups the ante a little later when she says, sin is necessary. Now, there is a really radical statement. Sin is necessary. And then the word of assurance that follows this, she says, sin is necessary, but all will be well, and all will be well, and every kind of thing will be well. And that's sort of vintage Julian. There's this profound sense of hopefulness in Julian. This profound sense that God will out in the end, and it's going to be okay. It's really going to be okay. And so she really holds that in a kind of tension with this recognition of the reality of sin, and at the same time saying things are going to be okay. What does she say? Well, she says, well, and this was, see, all this stuff that I said, she thought this is part of what God has revealed to her through the visions that she saw. So she wants to claim this as revelation from God. And that was, you know, that was an important point for her, particularly as a woman, because here she is claiming really the authority to write and to teach, and that was really not granted women in this period. Women could maybe teach in the context of, say, a nunnery where women are teaching other women, but for Julian to have the audacity to claim to even be able to teach other men, that's pretty radical. Well, her justification is, I've been given this revelation by God. And who am I? Who am I not to preach and teach if God has told me to preach and teach? Okay. So she says, sin is necessary. How then is everything going to be well? That's her question for God. God's answer is, contemplate the atonement. Contemplate Jesus' passion. And know that I, God, will set all things right. She says, sin is ordered to have a great reward. So God allows for sin in order to bring about something better. And this is the theory that's sometimes called the theory of the blessed fall. That is, that in some sense, you know, the fall into sin in the Garden of Eden, however you take that, Julian, he took it literally, as far as we can tell. The fall into sin in the Garden of Eden was, in a sense, good. Now we got to listen to Julian some more. Thank you. He's hot.
Sorry about that.
The fall into sin is, in some sense, good. You know, and obviously the question is just like Paul, when Paul says, shall we sin so that grace may abound? Julian knows that's the next question. And she says, well then, if sin is ordered so that we can have a great reward, shall we go out and sin? And Julian's very careful, you know. She says, no, we're not supposed to do that. She says, we are supposed to hate sin, but, she says, we are always, hate sin, but always to love ourselves. Always, and love our fellow Christians. So why is sin necessary then? Why is sin necessary? Julian says it's necessary because we needed to fall both to know how feeble and wretched we are in ourselves and to know the depth of God's love. And see, what's going on here is, if we ask, why did Jesus die on the cross? There's sort of, well, there's several different theories about that, but two that I'll mention. One is a theory that said Jesus had to die on the cross in order to pay the penalty for our sins. And that's probably the one that most of us are more familiar with. Jesus died on the cross in order to pay off God, because God is a righteous God, right? This is not Julian's theory now, but let me just talk about this theory for a minute. This is the theory of St. Anselm, and sometimes called the penal satisfaction theory. So I always tell my students, if you want to think about, try to remember Anselm's theory of the atonement, you remember the Rolling Stones, because it's about satisfaction. Satisfaction. And this theory is about satisfaction. And what needs to be satisfied in this theory? See, what needs to be satisfied is God's justice. God is a just God who, and what that means is that God is a just God who requires that sins be punished and good deeds be rewarded. Okay? And if you say that, then you might well say that the reason Christ died on the cross was to pay that penalty for our sin. And of course there's scriptural support for that. This is really the theory of the atonement, the theory of why Jesus died on the cross. It's been dominant.
Okay.
Julian follows another character. He's known as Abelard. She doesn't mention Abelard, but clearly she's very Abelardian. And Abelard says, Anselm, you don't get it. You are emphasizing God's justice way too much. And God, Jesus' death on the cross is not about God's justice. It's about God's love. About showing us how much God that's not quite fair to Anselm, because Anselm will talk about God's love too, but he really emphasizes God's justice. And Abelard and Julian want to say, no, the reason Christ died on the cross was to show us how much God loved us. Okay, now how does that connect with this business about the fall being necessary? Well, it connects because if we hadn't fallen, we wouldn't have needed for Christ to come and suffer and die and show us the depth of God's love. So without that fall, you see, it's kind of like, I try to diagram it like this, you know, here we are as we're created. We're at this level. And then, in a sense, we do fall into sin, and so we're at a lower level, so to speak. But then, and this is what Julian really wants to emphasize, because of this line is the redemption in Christ. Because of that redemption, we get somewhere that we couldn't be otherwise. So, here's this going down. I guess this is sin down here. Or maybe this is a fall and this is sin. I don't know. But the point is that this part is necessary because in the whole economy of things, it gets us to somewhere that we wouldn't have been otherwise. Because it enables then God to send Christ and for Christ to suffer and for us to realize the depth of God's love. That God would come to our world and suffer on our behalf. But to say Jesus is about paying a penalty for sin, Julian just says, we don't need that. So what it's all about, in fact, the very conclusion to Julian's work, she says, I asked about the meaning of my revelations for 20 years, she says, and the answer to all my questions was love. Who was revealed? She says, love. What was revealed? Love. Why was it revealed? For love. So, I mean, everything for Julian is about the love of God. And she really wants to focus on that. And so this business about God's justice is not something that, let me just hold on to
this. Is Joanne saying that she was saying that we have to sin to experience the fall so that we can gain something more than where we were when we started out?
Yeah.
Sort of no pain, no gain, of course.
Yeah, it's sort of like that. Uh-huh. And you see, that she's trying to come to terms with the meaning of our suffering. And that's the way she does it, is that the sense that it leads us somewhere we couldn't be without it. Yeah. Yeah. How does that strike you?
What about the economy of the whole thing? How can you say that the suffering of the Jews in the Holocaust, in a horrible way in which families were torn from their homes and died in those ovens, or other unspeakable kind of atrocities. Mm-hmm. What kind of God would use that in order to even get us to a higher plane?
Well, I think that's a good question. I think that's our question in a way. I want to guard against presentism here and say, you know, I think that's a legitimate question to come to Julian with. I think we need to remember that that precise question wouldn't be hers, because suffering on that scale or that type, thank Shane.
Is she more individual focused as opposed to corporate in terms of sin?
That's a good question. I don't know, Jim. I don't know about that one, because I think she's not worried about systemic evil, systemic sin, the way we might be, you know. But again, I think it's kind of unfair to expect that of her, you know, because again, I think that's more
right.
Our issue. There's a way in which, let me try this. One of the things she struggles with, and she says, there are two judgments. There are two kinds of judgments. Two judgments. One is the judgment of the church, right? And she said, the judgment of the church consigns some people to hell. Okay? And then she says, and I think what I'm doing here is I'm trying to sort of find something in her that I think would resonate with some of our social. So this is where I'm going. There's the judgment of the church, which consigns some people to hell. And, on the other hand, you see, there's the judgment of God, who does not blame. There's no... You see, because, again, for her, God is pure love. And so God does not... You see, one of the things she'll finally say is, to talk about God forgiving doesn't make sense. Because for her, God was never angry. So you see, there's just a real different spin from the way we're used to. We're used to thinking. So she says, there's these two judgments. There's one of the church that consigns some people to hell, and there's one of God who does not blame us. And she says, oh, what are we going to do? How do we? Obviously, these two judgments don't quite agree with each other. And here she is. Remember. A woman in a somewhat precarious position in the sense of claiming some teaching authority in a male-dominated church, wanting to be a loyal daughter of the church at the same time. She's going to talk about her revelation because God has given it to her. Okay, so what's she going to do? She says, well, here's her resolution. Her resolution is both judgments are true. Okay. Tell me more, Julian. And she said, both judgments are true, but the judgment, the lack of judgment in God is the higher truth. Therefore, we should concentrate on this one. Okay, now why did I say that in response to your question? I said that in response to your question because what I think's going on here in Julian is a very subtle, but I think pretty profound critique of the institutional church of her day. And notice how she wouldn't like this language, but she's just got her butt so well covered here. You know? I mean, because on the one hand, I think she's got this real
profound critique of the church going on. On the other hand, she wants to say, it sort of reminds me of Elizabeth Schussler Fiorenza, who wants to say, I'm a radical feminist, and I am going to interpret scripture with a feminist hermeneutic, but, and so I'm not going to do it the way the church has always said it has to be interpreted, but you can't throw me out, because I'm going to claim that I belong here. You know, I mean, in a way, I see that kind of thing going on with Julian, saying, look, the judgment of the church is true, but here's this higher truth that we really have to focus on. I mean, I kind of like that. I just think that's really the sort of political savvy there. Is that Joe?
Well, I'm just thinking we have to allow her time and place, 14th century, and that's medieval, that's before the Reformation, where the whole Corpus Christiani, the whole world is church in Europe that she's living in. At least I think to understand her today, we have to almost put ourselves within the Roman Catholic Church and think of ourselves or her as a devout Catholic today.
And she was, yeah.
Which we should make, she's criticizing the papacy subtly, but she's saying that God is pure love. Very radical for her time.
And really, I mean, what I think is profound is that critique of the judgment of the church, the judgmentalism of the church. Yeah.
How did she square with the church?
Well, she seemed to have got on, from all we know, she got on real well. She claims in her writings that I want to be true to the teachings of Holy Church. That's the way she always talked about it, Holy Church. And we don't know the details of her life, but as far as we can tell, she was able to live her life out in that cell.
Had she taken orders?
We don't know, but don't think so. Don't think so. I mean, the anchorites were different. They were individuals, and they weren't part of a community. So I don't know the nature of the vows she might take.
Yeah. This is so appealing to say God is pure love,
yeah.
But I hear this no blame meaning sin is not sin, mm-hmm. and the fall is not a fall, and in some sense, nothing wrong has happened in the world because God is responsible and he's all perfect, so the sort of circular reasoning that kind of denies the reality of evil and sin in the world, even though she acknowledges the devil.
And I think that's another version of your question, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And I think that's a hard one for her. I mean, the way I might frame it is, does she take sin and evil seriously enough?
Maybe living in the cell, she didn't see as much of it.
The last time, one of the questions I posed is a helpful one to try to get at somebody is, what are they afraid of? And so I had this student a year ago who was a Christian but was also a witch. She was part of a Wicca coven. And here I was having her in this class in which we were doing early Christian fathers. You know, oh Lord. Her question for the early Christian fathers was, what are these guys so afraid of? You know, and finally it struck me, that is a really good question. You know, let's try to get into somebody's world. Let's ask, what is it that they're afraid of? Now, what we've said about Julian, what's she afraid of, do you think? What's Julian afraid of? What's she worried about? What's she responding to?
She's afraid that God is against us.
Uh-huh.
Or that he's capricious. Or that he's not sovereign.
Yeah.
This is probably naive. When was the Inquisition?
Later.
Later.
So it sounds like she's afraid of the judgment of the church.
She is. That's what I think. Yeah. That's what I think.
That she probably saw the oppression.
Yeah. Yeah, you see, and this is where I think, Joe, I think she really lines up with the kind of stuff you were talking about in Vespers on Monday.
I think she's aware of the fact that the judgment of the church, I mean, what's our typical way of proceeding in the church? We say, good, let's be good Lutherans. We say, we got to preach what? Law and gospel, right? First we preach the law, we preach God's judgment to people so that they can then hear the good news, right?
They are sinful and unclean.
That's right, that's right. And what Julian is saying, I think, is that we're so good at that first part. We're so good at preaching law. And the effect of that can be very often to beat people down so that when grace is preached, they can't hear it. They can't hear it. Now, and so, see, I think Julian is not worried about, she's not worried about pride. What she's worried about is these people that have heard judgment so much that they don't have a self anymore. That they can't hear. They can't hear grace and love anymore. So that she wants to go so far with that so as to say there is no judgment in God. Although she doesn't quite go that far because she says, well, this is a true judgment. It's not as true as this one. But it's true. Which is, and the question was, does she take sin seriously? Well, I think she says, I don't have to take sin seriously because the rest of the church is so darn good at it that, I think, at least that's the way I...
Is it because she thinks it's already atoned for?
Well, that's part of it.
And that she's focused completely on Jesus Christ and afterwards. And therefore, sin is not nearly as relevant anymore because it's already forgiven. Mm-hmm. And she's forgotten about the pre-Christian period.
But if there was no real fall, because God had never blamed and needed atonement, what was wrong with the original state of Adam and Eve?
Well,
that this would be a blessing of any sort.
Yeah.
What was lacking when they had perfection that is better now if God had never been angry in the first place?
Yeah. Well, if it really is a blessed fall, I guess it really is a fall up, so maybe my diagram was wrong. And see, I think her answer is going to be, you just got to see the whole picture. And for her, the whole picture is that the fall takes us somewhere that then redemption takes us, to somewhere. So it's not that the fall was bad, it's that the fall leads us to someplace better. I mean, it's just a different slant on things. I mean, I think that's a good question, but I don't... Yeah, you wanted to...
But it had to be. It had to be. The fall had to be.
For her, remember she said, it's necessary. And why is it necessary? It's necessary to sort of set in motion this whole process that's going
to
lead us somewhere higher.
What about free will? She talks about God being sovereign and yet and sin being real and he's responsible and nothing happens by chance.
Yeah.
Does she talk about free will at all?
Yeah, she does, and she's kind of like Augustine on that. She tries to get both sides on that. On the one hand, she wants to say, look, God's grace is what does it. And if you take a radical grace position, it gets hard to get free will back in the door. But she wants us to... But she'll also say things that sound like we have some ability to respond here.
Personal responsibility.
Yeah. But that's pretty typical of a lot of theology of her period that's trying to affirm both the reality and of God's grace and also the reality of human free will. So, Hyde, you wanted to...
Wouldn't heaven be higher than paradise?
I'm sorry?
Wouldn't heaven be higher than paradise?
You mean paradise being...
Lower.
Being creation.
Yeah, creation.
Yeah.
So that we...
Mm-hmm. So there is this...
That we have a chance to go to
there's
heaven.
There's this ascent going on. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we wouldn't have that chance without the fall. So...
But to say that is to say that there was something lacking in paradise.
Yeah.
And what
said, yeah.
Isn't it
why is heaven better?
Isn't it what was lacking was an awareness... Human awareness of the death of God's love.
Mm-hmm. I think that's what she would say. I think that's exactly what she'd say.
Yeah.
We couldn't know the depth, we couldn't know how much God loved us without going through all this. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Knowing her as you do, could you speculate on something that she might say if she knew about the Holocaust?
Yeah. Gosh. Have a little vision.
Yes.
It was evil all around in her time. That was a time of tremendous suffering and misery and exploitation of serfs and peasants being raped or pillaged and, you know, just wars.
And I think in part she's responding to that and trying to say, look, there's something more. And I mean, her position strikes me as rather too otherworldly for me. But I need to hear it and take it on its own terms.
I know it's not fair, but how is she different than a Pollyannish person?
How is she different from Pollyanna? What do you think? Or does she sound any different?
I mean, superficial maybe. You really get into the suffering of God in Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not part of Pollyanna.
No, and that's central for her, though, you see.
Yes, right.
Because
that's what I say. You have to get into
that. That's right there. I mean, the focus is on the passion of Jesus.
Yeah.
And that's how we see, that's how we know the love.
And God isn't asking even the Holocaust of us any more than he was willing to.
Right.
God was willing to do
right.
in Christ.
Right.
God, you know, put himself on the line of this one.
She has a really high Christology. So,
right.
And in fact, she says when she asked for to have a vision of the Passion and to experience for a moment what Jesus suffered on the cross, and when she did that, she regretted it. Because for her, the suffering of Jesus on the cross is the suffering of God, and we couldn't really bear it.
And then this almost presupposes thinking almost in a kind of anthropomorphic way about God.
Oh, it does.
God is really in the suffering, like we do. I mean, not just pretend, not just off in the distance, not vicariously, not spiritually, but. To suffer the pain. Mm-hmm.
Let me just, we need to quit here. But I want to mention one other thing that I just find really exciting about her. The Trinity is real important for her. And the Trinity that comes out for her is Father, Mother, and Spirit. She stands in a tradition that identifies Jesus as God the Mother. She talks about the Father is our protection, and the Son or the Mother is the perfection of our sensuality, our restoration and salvation. And the Holy Spirit is the reward and gift of our labor. So we've got Father who is being, and Mother who's our increasing, and Holy Spirit who's our reward. So that's the way she pictures the Trinity. And talks about Christ as our true mother, because Christ gives birth to us into our new life, and Christ feeds us with himself. So the stuff of Jesus' mother is real powerful and worked out in some detail. Now, she wasn't the first to do that, and she doesn't stand alone, but she really accentuates that. And then here's another way in which, you know, we think God the Mother is a hot 20th century concept. Well, forget it. You know, about 5 centuries ago, here was Julian and other folks saying, God is our mother. So I just get real excited talking about Julian.
So what influence has she had?
I don't know how much she's been read. She hasn't been available in modern English until the last 20 years. And part of her problem was that she didn't write in Latin. So which was the, you know, the dominant language of the period. So how many people read her even then? I mean, in a way, she's probably a lost treasure that wasn't well known for a lot of years, and then that has been recovered just in recent times.
In your introduction to her, you said she had two windows, one into the church and one to the tower. Was there a door?
I don't know. I don't think so.
How did you get in?
Who was her support community? Was it the lay people of the town?
I don't know for sure. One suspects she may have had a patron.
Well, Morgan Anchorites had a support people who are in the community who came around.
Certainly to bring her food.
In Meteora,
at least. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. We just don't know many details about it.
She didn't write about that.
No.
That's post-vision. Huh?
That's right. Well, it's just, not important to her, you know? What she wants to write about is her vision and about what that tells us about God. Well, if we're to be on time, we need to quit now, but thank you for tonight.
Thank you.